Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the co-founder and co-director of Code Pink, Jody Evans, and discuss plans that the peace, environment, women's rights and social justice activists has to celebrate Mother's Day. We will discuss Thursday's Close Gitmo Now rally at the West Los Angeles Federal Building and the continuing stain that America's gulag at Guantanamo is for the United States overseas and the perversion of justice it represents as it undermines our values at home. Then we'll analyze the recently released report by the Pentagon on China's military capabilities and discuss the administration's public efforts to call out China on its widespread use of cyber espionage that targets American corporate and government secrets. Alan Paller, the director of research at the SANS Institute, who issues the annual Greatest Risk to Cybersecurity study, joins us to discuss growing concerns that America's drones and missiles can be captured in cyber attacks and redirected to targets chosen by our adversaries. Then finally, we will look into the deceptive political campaign organized by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and other tech billionaires that is supposed to be about promoting immigration reform, but has instead financed TV ads that slam Obama's so-called Chicago-style politics, attacks Obamacare, and promotes the Keystone XL pipeline and drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Josh Orton, the political director at Progressives United, who are leading a coalition of activist groups to pull ads from Facebook, joins us to discuss the social media mogul's wolf in sheep's clothing politics. And joining us now is Jody Evans, who is co-founder and co-director of Code Pink. She has been a peace, environmental, women's rights, and social justice activist for 40 years and has traveled extensively to war zones promoting and learning about peaceful resolutions to conflict. She served in the administration of Governor Jerry Brown and ran his presidential campaign. She has published two books, Stop the Next War Now and Twilight of Empire, and has produced several documentary films, including the Oscar-nominated The Most Dangerous Man in America and Howard Zinn's The People's Speak. Jody is the board chair of Women's Media Center and sits on many other boards, including Rainforest Action Network, Drug Policy Alliance, Institute for Policy Studies, Women Moving Millions, and Sisterhood is Global Institute. She's a mother of three. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Evans.
Thanks, Ian.
And this situation in Guantanamo is becoming increasingly Kafkaesque. You have, of the 166 detainees still there, 86 of the detainees have been cleared for release, and the Congress has forbidden the prisoners from being transferred to U.S. soil, and the administration has been searching for foreign countries to take them, and nobody will. So needless to say, the detainees are very unhappy and increasingly frustrated, and this has led to the fact that 93 of the camp's 166 detainees are now on a hunger strike. You couldn't invent a more embarrassing mess if you tried.
Well, and I just want to correct one thing about the countries won't take them. The way, you know, we've been outside the White House every January 11th. Medea and I went to Guantanamo and protested outside with a mother of one of the detainees in 08. This has been an issue we've cared about, you know, since 2001. But we were just planning our trip to Yemen, where we'll meet again with, like we did in Pakistan, with the drone victims' families, and found out that Yemen has been demanding these prisoners to come home to Yemen, has promised to take care of them, has built a facility to rehabilitate them, and that Obama's still not releasing them. And so today, we sent out an alert to our national list from one of the mothers of one of the prisoners, Abdurrahman, and she pleads, she's in Yemen pleading with the mothers in America, you know, here is a day for joy, but it's a day for her of grief. And she says, can you imagine what it's like to be a mother whose first job is to love and feed her child, and that your son is in a loveless place refusing nourishment to protest his detention and to think of him being painfully force-fed? She says it breaks her heart every second of every day. And then she said that we have stolen her son's youth. He's been there for 12 years, and the peace and joy of their life for that 12 years, that her younger sons have fallen into depression, stopped school, And that his wife was pregnant when he was taken in Pakistan, where he'd gone to teach. And their daughter is now 12 years old. And she was writing a note thanking everyone. We've got about 1,250 people on a hunger strike with the prisoners in Guantanamo. And she wrote a note thanking them. She said, "Thank you from the bottom of my heart as a mother, which a heart that aches, my heart that yearns to hold my son again, to give him his favorite foods, and to tell him everything will be all right." So, you know, Obama could do this. He could have done this from the day, you know, 5 years ago. It's all in his power. And why he isn't is beyond baffling and horrific. And that now it's driven the prisoners on this hunger strike. You know, they're on day, like, 90. The force feeding, the head of the American Medical Association has called it barbaric, that a force feeding is just barbarism against every law. And one of the prisoners described it like razor blades going down your nose and your throat.
So why is it then, if Obama, when he came in, he said he was going to close it, and more recently said he was going to close it, and he hasn't closed it? I thought that one of the reasons was that the guy that he beat in 2008 has done everything he can to frustrate him, along with Lindsey Graham, who is a JAG officer, a reserve in the Air Force, and that they have stitched him up at every turn in the Congress. What can he do? That is, he's either, in other words, he's either lying, or there is something he can do, and he's not saying what it is, or he's stymied.
I can tell you what he can do. Right. First of all, he needs to put somebody in charge out of his office. That they got rid of the person in the State Department whose job was to do this, and there isn't anyone that even has the job to do it. Right. So there's no effort at all. All of it can happen out of the White House. They just move the person to do it from the Pentagon over to the White House, name him, and empower him. The Chris Engers from ACLU said that all it needs is this one point person, and they've been begging for it for the last 5 years. And then Congress put up this, like, waiver process, but it can be gone around so the White House continues to contest all these prisoners' habeas corpus cases that CCR has filed for all of them. All Obama has to do is tell the Justice Department to stop contesting the cases, and as soon as they do, the cases will be won, and the court will rule that they need to be let free. And that takes it totally away from Congress. The argument that there's no country, Yemen has demanded these prisoners since they were put in. All these prisoners have been cleared for transfer and release, most of them from back in 07. And when, you know, the Bush administration let go like 500 of the prisoners, and these are some of the ones that were left. So they have been transferred for release, and they just continue to be held. It's all there. There's a one other thing. There's an executive order that he signed so that there would be the establishing a review procedure, and he's never used it. And if he did, the review boards met and reviewed that they should be sent out, they can be sent out. So, you know, there's other things that can be done, but, you know, he's not going to do that. He could declare an end to hostilities with Al-Qaeda, and everything that governs the hostilities would be moot. But we know that's not going to happen. But I've said like five things that he could do.
So it's kind of mystifying, though, Jody Evans, why he doesn't do any of those things, because quite simply, this situation is a stain on America. It's a stain on America's reputation abroad, which has already been badly damaged the torture issues. And it's also a mockery and a perversion of justice, undermining our rule of law at home. Because the paradox here, I talked to the former chief JAG officer of the United States Navy, Admiral Hudson, the other day. He's been trying to get those prisons out since day one. And he says the irony here is that if you actually go on trial and get tried and convicted and do time, you get out and get free, or you get released. But under this indefinite intention, you can rot there forever. And there's only one person being put on trial, the Australian guy.
Yeah, one person, right?
Right.
And also, you know, just to encourage everyone to call them prisoners and not detainees, which was the Bush way to get around the law and not, you know, have justice not available to them from day one. Again, you know, like you said, that if they're prisoners, they're treated in a very different way, and they just kind of, they're in a black hole of injustice. And, you know, it's no different. It's the drone attacks that you didn't mention that have also, that are staining our reputation globally, where we are killing 95% innocent people to 5% of what we call targets that aren't even really legal targets. It's, you know, what the Obama administration is doing, if the Bush administration would have done this, we would have been in the streets, we would be screaming. And what's hard for us is just to watch the silence. Code Pink has been on the hunger strike outside the White House every day. Diane Wilson, one of the co-founders of Code Pink, is out there, you know, all day, every day. Medea went today to the offices of Harry Reid, Carl Levin, who's the head of Armed Services, and Dianne Feinstein, head of Intelligence, and Leahy Judiciary. And they did a prayer service in the Hart Building. I mean, it's just been nonstop because, you know, how do you hunger strike for 90 days and force feeding? I don't know. And I think for me as a woman, you know, like knowing the history of our right to vote and that the way they tortured the women who fought for that was force feeding. And we've heard that story through time about how abusive and horrific that is. And here we're doing this. And then, you know, today and yesterday celebrating the release of these women that were kidnapped and raped. But in a way, we have kidnapped all these men and held them in the same way, you know, on leashes and in torture it's like the zombies have taken over Obama's brain or heart or something, because it doesn't even make sense. You don't even know how to think about it because it's so many ways that organizations have shown him what he can do to make this different. And these lives that you just, from the moment you know that they were innocent from being picked up, you know, by some bounty fee that we're giving so that somebody wants to get rich off of someone else's life, and then they're imprisoned in this horrible place. I mean, I you know, protested outside Guantanamo, and it's horrible. It's just horrible. There is no answer to why this is happening.
And we're about, Guantanamo costs $150 million a year, and they've asked for $220 extra million to upgrade it. It costs to house a federal prisoner $25,000 a year. It costs to house a prisoner at Guantanamo $800,000 a year. So just in terms, though, of what you're doing on Mother's Day, of course, is Sunday, but tomorrow, I understand.
Well, the call is before Mother's Day so that everyone can get engaged before. And so tomorrow, outside the federal building at Veteran and Wilshire, from 4 to 6, we will be holding a vigil of moms and activists across Los Angeles, joining with others in New York and San Francisco and Washington, D.C. and London and Rome and Yemen. And so we call on everyone to join us in solidarity with these mothers and these prisoners.
And just because I'm completely puzzled as to what possible motive Obama could have you figured it out? I mean, is it because he's continually trying to reach out to the Republicans to make a deal? And they clearly, the guy that was about to make a deal on the background, gun checks background, the Republican Toomey, who joined with a Democrat, he says that the reason his Republican colleagues voted against it was because they just hate Obama and want to let him have any success. So I don't understand why he's, what possible motive he could have not to act unilaterally if he's being stymied at every turn.
Well, I mean, you know, there's $8 million questions around lots of things that Obama's doing, including kill lists. So I don't know where to start.
But you must have thought about it. I mean,
I do. It's baffling. It doesn't make sense at all on any level.
And, you know, his nemesis, Lindsey Graham, is now holding up the Secretary of Energy because they want to close this mixed oxide fuel plant in Savannah River, South Carolina, which was budgeted at $1 billion, is now up to $7.7 billion, and is going to convert bomb-grade plutonium into commercial reactor fuel, which, of course, gives a lie to the idea of the peaceful atom. I mean, there's an awful lot of things that you could a lot of reasons to go after Lindsey Graham, and he's been the most effective and vocal proponent of Guantanamo.
Well, I would say, you know, the answer I keep coming up with is that Obama just lacks any courage. You don't see him exercising courage, and action for him just seems close to impossible. I mean, the things that you and I look at that seem so easy, if he just would step up and do it, and that would shift, you know, talk about winning hearts and minds. To close Guantanamo, you would globally win hearts and minds. This is a global issue that everyone looks at and just, you know, shame on the United States. And what could the possible trade-off to that be, you know, with a Lindsey Graham or with anyone? It's human, it's humane, it's justice. This is, you know, if one of these, you know, if now 9 innocent prisoners have already died inside of Gitmo, are we really going to start, what happens when these hunger strikers start dying?
Well, they seem to be prepared to, and they're in a hopeless situation.
They are very prepared to. They've been through hell and worse than death for the last 12 years. And being force-fed is worse than torture. So these are innocent people. These are people kind. I know some of the ones that have come out, and the kindest, most gentle people who were going to teach. One as a human rights lawyer. I mean, what we have done is just, it's unfathomable. It really is. When you try to put it in your brain, you can't rock it.
Well, it is, because it was, after all, it was Bush and Cheney who scooped these people up willy-nilly without thinking about it and without having any kind of end game. And Obama's stuck with it, and it's doing nothing but shame him and shame the country. It is truly baffling. And I thank you, Jody, for what you're doing tomorrow at the Federal Building.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jody Evans, who is the co-founder and co-director of Code Pink. She has been a peace, environmental, women's rights and social justice activist for 40 years and has traveled extensively to war zones promoting and learning about peaceful resolution to conflict. She served in the administration of Governor Jerry Brown and ran his presidential campaign, and has published 2 books, Stop the Next War Now and Twilight of Empire. And she's produced several documentary films, including the Oscar-nominated The Most Dangerous Man in America and Howard Zinn's The People Speak. Jody is the board chair of Women's Media Center and sits on many other boards, including Rainforest Action Network, Drug Policy Alliance, Institute for Policy Studies, Women Moving Millions, and Sisterhood is Global Institute. She is a member, mother of 3. And we are going to take a brief station break and back talking about the Pentagon's report that just came out about China's military capabilities.
Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song? What you wanna do? Wanna be hackers, code crackers, slackers, wasting time with all the chat room yackers, 9 to 5 chilling at Hewlett Packard, working at a desk with a dumb little placard. Yeah, paying the bills with my mad programming skills, defragging my hard drive for thrills. I got me 100 gigabytes of RAM. I never feed trolls and I don't read spam. Install the T1 line in my house. Always at my PC, double clicking on my Miz house.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Powler, who's Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. He directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate, and in 2007, eWeek and Baseline magazine selected Alan as one of the 100 most important people in the information technology industry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Powler.
Thank you, Ian.
And this week, the Pentagon issued its annual report to Congress on China's military capabilities, and it has been sort of accompanied by senior officials in the administration, the national security advisors and others, going public, accusing China of cyber espionage and developing cyber weapons. So it's not as if this is any great news, but the fact that they're going public with it, I guess, is the news. Is that what you think?
Exactly. For the last 5 years, the quiet truth has been that everyone from the Secretary of Defense through Homeland Security, through the power industry has known that they were under attack by China and other countries, but it was policy not to say something out loud. And in fact, when the person who ran the Air Force Cyber Command, Bill Lord, did accidentally say something out loud, he was called on the carpet for doing something he shouldn't have done. He said, China's stealing data. They've stolen 20 terabytes of data. So it's a major national policy change to speak out loud about it.
And what do you think the administration is hoping to do? Are they hoping to shame China into changing its behavior?
I think they're actually trying to start a dialogue that as long as they were being quiet about it, the public denials were all they got. So you'd hear someone say, I remember I said, China's doing this and the military is doing it, and the foreign ministry came out with a statement saying, Powler's wrong because in China, cyber espionage or cyber crime is punishable by death. So we don't allow it at all. And that was silly because they and 120 other countries are using cyber espionage. I really think this is saying it out loud to say, look, we're just not going to sit back and take it. We want to have a conversation about what level is acceptable in the theft of information, what level is acceptable in the, and this is really the important one, Ian, what level is acceptable in the infiltration of military command and control systems. So theft of information is one thing. That's been going on for thousands and thousands of years, but this is an age where other nations are actually penetrating our military command and control systems so that our commanders won't know where their missiles are going to go, and that has to stop. If a commander doesn't know where his missile's going, he can't go to war.
So if this is already happening, what that brings to mind, Alan Powler, is the loss of that very advanced stealth drone that disappeared over Iran, and the Iranians claimed that they were able to intercept its command and control and bring it down largely intact. And the assumption was a lot of that information went to China. Is it in any way possible that China was working with Iran to do that? I mean, explain how you can do that. If you hack into the data stream, and since we're more and more relying on drones and robotics, you can see what a picture of vulnerability this brings to all of these new high-tech weapons.
Yeah, you've hit on the one that is the most, that generates the most argument. So the military leaders say, no, Iran did not hack into it. But then they have absolutely no explanation for exactly how it came down intact inside Iran's borders rather than crashed. So no one knows for sure, but here's how it would happen. These drones and a lot of our satellites, most of NASA satellites, were built before the risk of someone else taking control of your weapon systems was real. And so they were built by using obfuscation. So instead of actually encrypting all the communications, they used communications that weren't encrypted, but they assumed the other side would never know what they were doing. And now, because communications is so much better and communications theft is so much better, other organizations and the U.S. can actually take over the command and control communications channel between the controllers and the satellites, between the controllers and the drones. We're redoing all of those with encryption and with much better security, but for the older ones, and most of the ones that are flying today are, have the older designs, it's just a dangerous situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Powler, who's the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution, and the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. He directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risk in Cybersecurity Studies. So, of course, what the report doesn't acknowledge is what similar abilities are being developed in the United States. And my understanding is that the military cyber command is one of the fastest growing parts of the military.
It is the one that's getting the most uptick in budget, for sure. It has spectacular capabilities, but there is a mismatch in spending. The admiral who ran the cyber command for the Navy, Bernie McCullough, told us that the other side, is outspending the U.S. 4-1 on taking command and control of kinetic weapons. What he means by kinetic weapons are these drones and the missile systems. So, yes, we've got great people, but the other side has been spending a long time getting inside our control systems for the power companies, control systems for the banks, control systems for the telecom companies, and control systems for the military. So we've got a little bit of work to do, and we need to do it in a hurry.
Well, you know, I'm out here in Hollywood, Alan, and a lot of screenwriters are probably listening to this program, and I imagine they're already coming up with a screenplay where the United States targets a military target somewhere to take out what they consider to be a bunch of bad guys, and somebody hacks into the missile and diverts it to blow up a children's kindergarten.
Well, with the creativity of the guys out there, I expect they're way ahead of us on this one. But yes, that's a real worry. It's not a small worry. And self-inflicted wounds of that magnitude can essentially take away the public will to fight. So here's the situation. We have two things we need to do as a nation. One is to reduce the vulnerabilities, and the other is to build the talent that can find the malicious actors who've gotten through the defenses we already have. We're not doing either of them very well yet. We know how to do it. Jim Lewis at the Center for Strategic and International Studies did a wonderful little report called Raising the Bar that explains exactly what we need to do on the first part. And on the second part, there is some movement, but most of the colleges are putting out what we call frequent flyers, people who can tell people what they need to do but can't do it. So the U.S. has to step up its cybersecurity education a lot like it had to step up its science and engineering education after Sputnik, because we're way behind the eight ball right now.
Well, presumably when the Secretary of Treasury went to Beijing, Jacob Lew, and also the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, they discussed these matters with the Chinese authorities. And sometime back, I think about 3 months ago, the New York Times reported that the computer security firm Mandiant had identified the People's Liberation Army's Unit 61398 out near Shanghai as the likely source of some of the biggest thefts in data from American commercial companies and government computers. So you said earlier that we're trying to start a dialogue. It looks like we already have started a dialogue. What do we know about the Chinese military's arrangements with hackers? Do they have them in-house, or do they have in-house hackers and then they have a cadre of freelance hackers?
I'll answer that question in a moment, but let me do a context setting one for 30 seconds. It doesn't matter how good they are, because Iran is also building talent, Russia is also building talent, Israel's building talent, France is building talent. There are 125 nations with a lot of talent. If we start thinking we can stop cybersecurity attacks by going after the actors, we're crazy. There are millions of actors now, including organized crime groups. So we have to build better defenses. But having said that, let me answer your question. Every spring, every PLA district in China runs a competition. and the winners of the local competition enter a regional competition to see who the best cyber people are. And they get people they've caught hacking, and they get other people who volunteer to compete. And in 2005, for example, the Chengdu district, which is in Sichuan province, got a bunch of graduate students from Sichuan University to compete. And one of them, Tan Wei Lin, his nickname is Wicked Rose on the Internet, but he won the local competition. His team won the regional competition. And then he dropped out of graduate school. This is September. He goes dark. And in December, we find his signature all over the Pentagon. That December 2005 was when the Secretary of Defense's computers were broken into. And then in the summer of 2006, his team was responsible for 5 zero-days. A zero-day is like a skeleton key in cybersecurity. It opens all locks. So real talent, and they as a nation have been doing that for a decade, all over the country, looking for great talent who can both create offensive weaponry, but also build good defenses. That's what we're not doing. And those people sometimes go directly to work for the military. Sometimes they work as contractors for the military. Sometimes they work as freelance and then sell the stuff back to the military. But it's all of the above in answer to your question.
And selling the stuff back would be, say, if they hacked in to Lockheed, which I understand happened with a stealth radar, which ended up in China, which is in China's new stealth fighter, which a lot of aviation analysts say is better than the one that we have developed, the F-35.
Yeah, that set of attacks was actually done by military people. I'm pretty sure. I mean, they didn't come out and write a report saying, look, here are our military people. But that set of attacks that got into Lockheed was called Titan Rain, and there was 24 workstations in, I forgot which province it was in, but we sort of found them because we found the router they were going through. So we knew that was in a particular place, and they made no keystroke errors over long periods of time. I was pretty sure that those were actual military people. So when the attacks are going against the major government contractors, and by the way, that's how most of our military secrets are being stolen. They're not being stolen from DOD. They're being stolen from the big defense contractors because that's where the engineering is being done. Those were almost all done by the military directly.
And is anything being done with these contractors? It's not as if the taxpayer is not generous to these contractors.
There has been a project called the Defense Industrial Base Project, which is meant to have them share data about when they get attacked and what they learn from it. What they haven't done is the simple controls that make it hard to attack. It's very interesting. They're actually out marketing cybersecurity services to people, and yet they aren't protecting their own systems with the basic controls in that paper raising the bar. Even Australia is ahead of our defense contractors. I shouldn't say even Australia. Australia has been very good at cybersecurity. But the Australian government is way ahead of our defense contractors in baking security. And as I said before, we know what to do on making it hard for the Chinese military to get in. We're just not doing it.
So how does this work, though, in terms of there's obviously no deterrence involved. It's not like nuclear weapons. And I understand that the president, when he authorized cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities early in his first term, he told his aides that he was worried that China and other states may use the American operation to justify their own intrusion. So is blowback a part of this?
There's two forms of blowback. One is what you described, which is you basically make it okay. You open Pandora's box. You make it okay for your adversaries to use the technique because you used it. That wasn't necessary. They didn't feel they had to wait. What's worse than that is that the weaponry you use in cyberspace doesn't destroy itself. When you drop a bomb on someone, they can't pick up that bomb and throw it back at you. When you use a weapon like the one used to destroy the centrifuges, the control system that controls those centrifuges, the Siemens system that controls those centrifuges, is identical to the Siemens systems that are used in the United States to control power systems. The same weaponry that can destroy rotating equipment in centrifuges can destroy rotating equipment in power systems. And Iran has already shown that they're angry and they're willing to fight back. They were behind the destruction of 30,000 computers at Aramco. They apparently were behind the the denial of service attacks against U.S. banks. They're basically testing our defenses right now, and so that's the first half of your answer. But the second half is just as much a danger. If you build an advanced weapon and use it, you better be prepared to defend against it coming back.
So in other words, the Stuxnet virus that was slipped into Iran's centrifuges and caused these cascades to crash, that could actually come back to shut down America's power supply.
Exactly. And we have lots of evidence that a third to a half of that attack is already underway. Not the last half, but the positioning of the technology. So it's a dangerous world we're playing in cybersecurity. And I'm not being hyperbolic about it. I mentioned to you earlier when the Israelis came in to destroy the nuclear plant in 2007 in Syria, the radar systems in Syria didn't work. They showed no planes, even though the Israelis were using non-stealthy aircraft. And then when you could hear the planes, the radar systems showed lots of planes that weren't there. There's active warfare being done in cyberspace, and we haven't really talked about it publicly because people don't want to scare people. But if you don't get a little bit scared, you won't do anything about it. And just sort of last item on this, it's cheaper to do security well than to do what we've been doing in security, especially in the federal government. They've been spending a fortune writing reports admiring the problem instead of fixing the problem. So we're not at all talking about we need to spend more money. We don't. We need to spend the money that we're spending well, take it away from the report writers, and use it to protect the systems.
So just for the sake of the audience, to follow what you just said about the alleged Israeli attack on the alleged nuclear reactor that allegedly built by the North Koreans in Syria.
Using the alleged radars allegedly provided to them by Iran, right?
By Iran. So
the Russian radars allegedly paid for by Iran, yes.
So the Israelis hacked into the latest Russian radar and confused it? Is that what you're talking about?
That's what I meant by taking command and control of kinetic tools. You can't shoot at something unless you can see it. And if your radar screens are blank, you can't shoot at it. So it doesn't matter whether you have a weapon system.
So just in the last minute or so, I mean, of course, the report, the Pentagon report issued on China's military capabilities estimates China's defense budget at $133 billion to $215 billion. Well, that's not exactly exact science, is it?
No, it's very challenging to define the edges of things. Even cybersecurity, there's the Congressional Research Service has some data from two or three agencies that say how many cybersecurity workers they have. And there's a factor of five difference between two different estimates from the same agency. So they don't have a clue how many people they have even working in the area, because sometimes they'll call every IT person a security person, and sometimes they'll only call people with very narrow responsibilities. So, no, there's no defining the exact level of expenditure. But it is pretty easy to find the waste, find where we're spending too much money and we don't need to.
Well, just in closing, Alan Pala, the DoD report also says that Russia and China are playing a disruptive role in international forums that are supposed to write the rules of the road and establish confidence-building measure and transparency in cyberspace. And it's pretty clear that both Russia and China are pushing for what they called an information security code of conduct, which would give governments the total authority over the content of information in the internet, not the users. You know, that's the great thing about the internet. That's what net neutrality and all these issues are about. So that would seem to be a forum where the people on the right side could assert their influence, and that there could be some serious public shaming, because I think everybody in the world wants the internet to be free. They don't want it to be controlled by governments.
I apologize, Ian. I just don't know what's going on in that forum. I've read the same stories, but I don't actually know what's happening in that forum. So
right.
No comment on it.
Yeah. The U.S. is arguing that international humanitarian law should apply to cyberspace, and the Chinese and the Russians are opposing that. I mean, that's what it comes.
I think that might be the forum where some good can be done. There are areas where Russia and China and the United States and France and all the other cyber savvy countries could work very well together on defense and raising the bars so it's very, very hard to do offense for either side, so that you don't have a lot of noise, you don't lose a lot of things just from carelessness. We don't need to fight with people about how to make computers safer. We might need to fight with them about how to take them over. But I think those forums should be focused on what to do to protect computers from attacks from both sides, to try to build a sort of a safer world. I think we can do a lot more in that arena.
Well, Alan Powler, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Powler, who's Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. He directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity study. Alan has testified several times before the House and Senate, and in 2007, eWeek and Baseline magazines selected Alan as one of the 100 most important people in the information technology industry. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's deceptive political campaign. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Josh Orton, who's the political director at Progressives United. Previously, he served as executive producer for Air America's Majority Report with Sam Seder and Janine Garofalo, and worked in communications and online outreach for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and on Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Orton.
It's great to be with you.
And your boss, Senator Russ Feingold, who heads up your organization, Progressives United, he has led the effort to essentially out Mark Zuckerberg and what they're up to with their political action group called Forward.us. Tell me about how did this get under the radar? I mean, I guess there's an assumption out there that Mark Zuckerberg, because he wears T-shirts and is young, is a sort of college liberal. But aren't a lot of these high-tech billionaires up in Silicon Valley, a lot of them are libertarians, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And you know, we've seen Mark Zuckerberg fundraise for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, for example. So I think that there's probably I would say it this way. I think Mark Zuckerberg's political beliefs are probably a bit more complicated than folks imagine.
So tell us about what he's launched and why there's a kind of misunderstanding, an assumption that, well, the fact of the matter is he appears to be a wolf in sheep's clothing, does he not?
Well, I'm not sure I would say that. What Mark Zuckerberg launched with other tech entrepreneurs was a Forward.us or Forward.us, which is an organization ostensibly created to forward the cause of comprehensive immigration reform. It includes two subsidiary organizations, one Democratic leading called the Council for American Job Growth, and one conservative called Americans for a Conservative Direction. And those organizations are basically running the politics on both sides of the aisle. And now, instead of running ads in favor of comprehensive immigration reform, what sort of popped on the radar was that these two subsidiary organizations were running ads in states where in states that have senators up for that are both up for re-election and are relevant senators on the issue of immigration reform. We saw one in Alaska running to support Senator Mark Begich, and one in South Carolina running in support of Senator Lindsey Graham. Both these ads had said absolutely nothing about comprehensive immigration reform. The ad running in South Carolina extolled the virtues of the terrible Keystone XL pipeline, criticized President Obama, talked about Chicago-style politics, and started to relitigate the 2009 stimulus and Obamacare. No mention at all of immigration reform. And the one running in Alaska extolled the virtues of drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Preserve. So what a group of organizations did, led by Progressives United, nine, now 10 organizations, including a new organization that joined on today, Ultraviolet, we're calling on Forward.us to change course. We think that the voters in these states are absolutely capable of having a conversation about comprehensive immigration reform. We think the strategy is cynical. We think it's frankly condescending to voters. We think it needs to change course. In the end, we think that Mark Zuckerberg and other tech industry leaders have a completely legitimate story to tell about why comprehensive immigration reform is good for their businesses, is good for the tech industry, and is good for the American economy. It's totally legitimate for them to tell that story. When they run into problems is when, they're trying to get sort of too cute by half here by running these ads, which some consultant probably told them are necessary to support the senators, even though they have nothing to do with immigration reform.
So, but surely in politics, you support what you support and what you stand for. This sounds far too complicated. And is it possible that Zuckerberg and company got had, that these Republican operatives wanted to propagate their propaganda and just went ahead and did it with his money? Is there a tactic to give these politicians political cover here?
Look, I certainly think that they probably got bad advice from consultants, and I wouldn't limit it to Republicans. They have Democratic consultants as well. And I think that basically they proposed a bad strategy and then they executed it poorly. I think we're getting to the point where we're beyond political organizations being able to run these types of ads under the radar with no expectation of blowback from the constituencies that are affected by the issues. What we're seeing is that this organization has faced several bad news cycles in the past couple weeks because people are catching on to the tactic. While they don't feature the ads on their website, it doesn't take much for some of these online publications to post them pretty quickly.
Again, I'm speaking with Josh Orton, the political director at Progressives United. Previously, he served as executive producer for Air America's Majority Report with Sam Seder and Janine Garofalo, and worked in communications and online outreach for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and on Barack Obama's presidential campaign. So I guess I'm a bit dense here, Josh, because I don't get the strategy that in order to help out vulnerable senators who would support comprehensive immigration reform, you run a bunch of hit pieces against Obama don't mention immigration reform. God's name is the voter going to know what this is about?
I think that, this is we're sort of looking at eight-dimensional chess here. My guess is if I'm a consultant and I'm trying to put my own head in the brain of a consultant who proposed this, I would say it would probably be something like, look, these two senators are up for re-election. They're getting hammered by anti-immigration groups. We need to show them that there's space to be in favor of immigration reform, and that there's a lot of money and organization to back you up if you do the right thing on comprehensive immigration reform, even if that sort of air cover or that support isn't explicitly about immigration reform. So the theory is that these leaders, these senators, will feel more comfortable doing the right thing on immigration reform if there's ads running in their state in support of them, regardless of what the ads say. Again, these consultants have been watching a bit too much House of Cards, but I'm not sure that the most cynical strategy is the winner anymore.
So what do we know about Zuckerberg and what's going on with him? I mean, there was an attempt. First of all, what your group is calling for, Progressive United, and you've been joined by MoveOn.org, Democracy for America, Credo, Daily Kos, Sierra Club, the League of Conservation Voters, 350.org, and Presente, and you just mentioned another group that has joined in.
Ultraviolet, yes.
You're pulling ads from Facebook to protest the position that their front group, Zuckerberg's group called Forward.us, has taken. Apparently, I think, was it Credo that tried to put up an ad on Facebook rejecting Zuckerberg's or criticizing Zuckerberg's approach, and it got pulled down, right?
Yeah, Facebook told Credo that they would not allow the ad because the ad featured a face, featured Mark Zuckerberg's face. And that was against their policies. Whether that is a policy uniformly enforced, I couldn't tell you. I do know that several of the organizations involved in this effort are launching and supporting a Facebook page with a similar aim. So we'll see what Facebook does with that. The one other thing I'd want to point out, though, is that this is the organization that Zuckerberg formed is a 501c4, and you hear a lot about these. You heard about a lot of these a lot in the last election. These are organizations that can take an unlimited amount of money and not disclose their donors, and then run ads basically about anything they want. Now, they're saying that they're not running election type ads, but look at where they're running the ads in states with senators who are up for re-election, and the fact that they're not running them on the issue that they're ostensibly supporting gives a pretty good indication that electoral politics actually does figure into their calculation. So, while the supporters of this organization have their, put up their faces and their bios right on Forward.us's website, it's absolutely unknown how much money each one gave, who contributed, and what exactly their future plans are. And so what we're trying to do is send a message that this organization needs to change tactics, because frankly, if they're willing to play this type of politics, it's impossible to know what other progressive values or issues are going to be thrown under the bus in the future. We've already talked about healthcare. They've already talked about the stimulus. They've already sort of trashed Chicago-style politics, which is really sort of a right-wing talk radio trope that we've heard since the Obama presidency. And they've supported policies that favor dirty energy. So, if they don't change tactics, it's hard to predict exactly what they'll throw at us next. But hopefully they'll see that. You see grassroots people who are involved in grassroots politics all over the country who just don't want to have this type of organization running this type of ads.
So Zuckerberg's group that he's formed, Forward.us, it's co-founded by him and by Nation Builders co-founder Joe Green, LinkedIn's Reid Hoffman, Dropbox's Drew Houston, and apparently a lot of other people in the tech industry. I thought this LinkedIn guy, didn't Obama appear at a LinkedIn venue and gave a speech?
It's possible. I don't recall off the top of my head.
All I know about him is that somehow I'm in their system and it drives me crazy because they make you feel like you have no friends in the world and are soliciting strangers to like you and to be your friend. It's the most embarrassing thing in the world to be.
Well, you don't have to like anybody you don't want to like.
Well, I'm saying you keep getting these messages every day. So-and-so, wants you to accept their friendship or whatever the hell.
Sure.
Or profession.
Yeah.
And it's like I feel bad. I don't even know these people, but I don't want to insult them. On the other hand, it's just an annoyance. But anyway, I'm sorry I'm digressing here. What are you hearing then, since you and this other group of progressive organizations have fired a shot across Zuckerberg's bow by pulling advertising from Facebook? Is he getting the message? Because, this political group that he formed bills itself as being bipartisan and dedicated to passing immigration reform. And here they are putting out really hardcore partisan hit attacks against Obama. Nobody in the world can pretend that this is not dishonest. Any word back? Any apologies? Any excuses? What's Zuckerberg saying?
Well, all we've seen is basically what others have seen in the press, which is that neither the the organization and Facebook itself are not really commenting. There was some boilerplate statement from Forward.us last week, but you know, I think that their strategy is probably going to try and let this blow over, and you know, I think that they want to continue, you know, if they want to continue with the strategy, I think they're going to have to address what I think are a growing number of grassroots political supporters across the country, and frankly, users of Facebook and many of the other technology platforms you mentioned, who don't want to see the revenue they create by their use of these platforms going into ads for policies that A, are aggressive, and B, they disagree with. Forward.us has to be getting the message at this point that they really need to change course. And I want to give credit to Credo, the San Francisco-based activism and phone company, for the work you mentioned last week when they tried to run an ad that was rejected by Facebook. They've been leading this charge, and I think over the course of the last couple of weeks, it's a bit hard to ignore. I think that kind of backlash for anyone savvy in the political space should have been expected. Forward.us launched in a very public, very I don't want to say gregarious, but in a very public, outward way, and placed the photos and the bios of all the partners on a website, and really launched auspiciously. And you know, to then engage in this kind of tactic, the backlash, I think, was almost inevitable. Of course, there are people who are involved in politics who have worked day in and day out to protect the environment, to pass healthcare reform, to revive the economy. To see these kind of ads running, the disappointment, I believe, was inevitable.
Well, if it's not cynical, it's incredibly clumsy what he's done. And, you know, he's a millennial, and the assumption is, politically speaking, that most millennials are fairly progressive. And I mentioned earlier that a lot of young people and college kids have ended up following Ron Paul and Rand Paul. So there's no question that libertarianism is also, a lot of millennials are gravitating towards it. So what's your sense then of pushback from the very users of Facebook? Are they, I mean, there's got to be a lot of Facebook users that are offended by this. Do they know about it? Are they doing
it? Not only Facebook. Yes, and that's one of the goals of the assembly here, is to use Facebook as an organizing platform specifically towards this cause. But you know, I don't think that we should limit this to just Facebook. I think that, you know, at this point, Zuckerberg's other partners in this entity are probably, in my estimation, at this point, probably wondering what they got themselves into. I applaud them on the ostensible goal of passing comprehensive immigration reform. It's a goal that every member of the coalition that we're a part of shares. But you know, at one point, I think they probably have to start having a conversation about comprehensive immigration reform. And if not, I think that the protest from the users of Facebook and the other technology platforms involved in Forward.us I think that the protest there is going to grow. I don't think this is going to go away as much as they probably want it to.
Well, Josh Orton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Josh Orton, who's a political director at Progressives United. Previously, he served as executive producer for Air America's Majority Report with Sam Seder and Janine Garofalo, and worked in communications and online outreach for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and on Barack Obama's presidential campaign. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.